man in charge. He had the clipboard with 1,000 names and 100 table numbers. He had the timetable. He had the notes for Locke's remarks and Adam's remarks. He had organized the volunteers. He was the point person for the production staff, for Siobhan and her crew, and for Max West in the green room. "If you have a question," Locke heard a woman wearing a black volunteer t-shirt say, "ask that cute guy in the madras pants." Locke had a question. He had a series of questions. There was, according to Ben Franklin, more than $50,000 missing from their bank account. $50,000. Locke had spent the whole day poring over the financials, while Gavin was at the tent organizing, just in case Ben Franklin was truly losing it. But no, Locke saw the cash skimmed from every deposit, and it made him sick. Not only would Gavin be fired, and possibly arrested, but Locke might lose his job as well, for not paying attention. Or he might be implicated in the whole scheme. It was unthinkable that Locke's name would be dragged through the mud for this. Locke was the first person to get a drink at the bar. He ordered glasses of white wine for himself and Daphne, and a Coke with a cherry for Heather, but the whole time he kept his eye trained on Gavin, who was clearly in his element with his clipboard and his earpiece, basking in his own self-importance. How could Locke feel anything but grossly betrayed? Betrayed one minute and hypocritical the next. Locke was hiding his own cache of sins, and it was for this reason alone that Locke had decided to wait until after the gala to confront Gavin. He would do it quickly and kindly, not only to minimize negative press toward Nantucket's children, but also for Gavin's sake. Locke drank his first glass of wine quickly. Across the green expanse of field, he saw Claire. She was stunning. Damn it. The sight of her pained him. The dress she wore was light green and gold, and it draped around her body in such a way that Locke could easily picture her nude underneath the lacy material. Her legs looked amazing because of her high heels, and she negotiated with the heels gracefully, even in the grass. Her hair had been straightened and smoothed, and it fell around her face in beautiful lines. She was luminous, a movie star. Everyone was looking at her. Everyone wanted to talk to her. Locke felt a surge of jealousy. She was his. Locke got another drink. He had to be careful. He didn't want to have too much before he gave his remarks, thanked everyone for coming, and started the PowerPoint presentation. But his mind was careening one way and then another. It was a sled without a rider, whoosh, down the mountain, down a double fault line. Gavin, Claire, Daphne, Heather. Around him, the cocktail hour was in full swing. Everyone was chatting and laughing. He had to get out there and shine. That was his job. He wanted first to find Daphne and Heather. Daphne needed monitoring, and Locke didn't want to squander a single second with Heather. She was leaving for school in 2 days, but there were people to talk to. They appeared, one after another, popping up in his path, hands to shake, connections to establish or reinforce. He wanted to keep his eye on Claire and Gavin. He oozed schmooze, but his mind was a runaway. He spied Isabel French looking lovely in a red dress. Isabel was another wild card. She had been so upset, so offended by the slight in the magazine. She had told Locke that she would see the gala through to the end, but then she was resigning from the board, withdrawing her financial support. It would be another stain on Locke's record. Locke saw Daphne and Heather talking to one of their neighbors. Daphne held her wine glass aloft for Locke to see. He repaired to the bar to get her another drink. Daphne, Claire, Isabel, Gavin. Gavin. When Locke approached the bar, Gavin was standing there alone. He was slouching against the bar in an uncharacteristically casual way, as though he were playing a part in a Western. When he saw Locke, he grinned.
"This is great," he said. "All these people, it's amazing."
Locke had overestimated his own kindness. He could not stand to listen to Gavin utter one word about how exciting the gala was when the man had single-handedly robbed the cause of more than $50,000. As Locke looked at Gavin now, the pieces of the puzzle fell into place. Gavin's skittishness around the office, his sense of proprietorship over the finances, his anxiety about getting to the bank at lunchtime, and the way that when he returned from the bank, he looked like the cat that had eaten the canary. Locke had actually wondered if Gavin had a crush on one of the tellers at the bank, so obvious was the change in his demeanor, from businesslike to slap-happy. It had been Ben's granddaughter Eliza who had called Gavin into question in the first place. She took special notice of the Nantucket's children transactions because her grandfather was on the board of directors. Why did Gavin walk with so much cash? Thousands of dollars, she told Ben. Doesn't seem right, she said. And Ben said,
No, my dear, it doesn't.
Locke had promised himself he would wait until Monday to discuss the financials with Gavin. But because of his anger, and the wine, and the zooming trajectory of his thoughts, he found he could not wait. It was just the two of them, alone, at the bar. No one else was around. What were the chances? It was a sign.
I have to talk to you about something, Locke said.
The smile fell off Gavin's face like a man jumping off a building.
I have the money in a duffel bag, he said, in my car. I want to give it back.
Locke stared. He was not prepared for the admission, nor the offer of restitution. He had the money in his car? He wanted to give it back?
It's not going to be that easy, Locke said.
Gavin cleared his throat.
I know about you and Claire, he said.
Now Locke was the one to lose his composure, or almost. But at that moment, the bartender slid Locke's drinks across the counter, and Locke was able to divert his attention long enough to accept the drinks and pitch a couple of bucks into the tip bowl.
Know about Claire?
No.
How?
Locke's eyes sought out Heather.
Jesus.
I don't know what you're referring to, Locke said.
Gavin sighed. I came into the office one night when you were there with her. I saw everything, heard everything.
Saw everything? Heard everything?
Locke's sensibilities were offended. One night when he and Claire were making love, Gavin had been present, watching?
Okay,
Locke said, with preternatural calm. He had made a tactical error. He should have waited, as he'd planned.
I will tell Daphne, Gavin said. I will tell Heather. I will tell Jason Crispin. I will tell Isabel. I will send the ugly truth through this tent, and by the time dinner is served, everyone will know.
You would do that? Locke said. Of course you would. You've been stealing from the cause for months, so it's no surprise that you would blackmail me to keep yourself from getting in trouble.
I want to give the money back, Gavin said. It was a mistake.
A mistake? Locke checked his surroundings to see if anyone was listening. Was the bartender listening? Locke had to seal this up somehow. He couldn't handle it now.
Let's talk about it on Monday, Locke said. You and me, in confidence. You'll come in at 7?
Gavin nodded once, briskly. Was he appeased? Would he keep his mouth shut? Did he trust Locke to save him? Why would he? It was safe to say that trust between them now was out of the question. What linked them was fear. Gavin took his glass of wine and his clipboard and disappeared into the crowd.
A mistake?
When you committed a crime or broke a commandment, either a religious commandment or one of your own making, and you did so willingly, with both eyes open, was it fair to call it a mistake?
Maybe it was, Never again, never again, never again.
Siobhan was shouting in her mind, but whispering under her breath. She would never again cater two titanic events back to back. She would never cater again without Carter. She would never cater again, period. She would sell the business and go back to making sandwiches and scooping ice cream at the pharmacy on Main Street. She would marry Edward Melior and live a life of leisure. She would go to lunch instead of making lunch and serving lunch, because this was hell. The tent she was working in was hot and airless. She had been up all night for 3 nights running, prepping the dinner, and because she didn't have enough staff, and because her husband was a compulsive gambler, she had ignored the past hors d'oeuvres. She had 500 pieces of 3 different things, which was, put mildly, not enough. Claire poked her head into the catering tent. Siobhan noted, unhappily, that Claire looked fantastic. She was freaking Heidi Klum in that sensational dress, and she had finally found a stylist who knew what to do with her hair. But Claire strolling in, all cool and beautiful, infuriated Siobhan. To make matters worse, Claire was wearing the strand of pearls that their father-in-law, Malcolm, had given her when she gave birth to J.D., the first child to carry on the Crispin name. She was flaunting her own good fortune by wearing those pearls. She was announcing herself as the have to her sister-in-law, the have-not. Siobhan felt like Cinderella. The little adulteress was out sipping Viognier while Siobhan slaved inside a plastic bag. Claire said, "There aren't enough hors d'oeuvres, Siobhan. People are complaining and they're getting very drunk. They've decimated the cheese table and the raw bar. The only things left are some lemon wedges and rinds of brie. You have to send out more food, pronto."
"Pronto?"
Siobhan wanted to slap her.
"I don't have anything ready," Siobhan said. "Let them get drunk."
"What?" Claire said. She looked around the tent. Siobhan's staff was furiously plating dinner. "Where is Carter?" Finally, she had noticed that Siobhan was doing this all alone.
"If I had to guess, I would say Harrah's in Atlantic City."
"What?" Claire said.
"I kicked him out. It's a long story that I do not have time to explain," Siobhan said. "Do you have anything else to say, or are you only here to ride my ass?"
"Siobhan..."
"Nice pearls," Siobhan spat.
Claire got the key to the concession stand from the security guard. It was time to bring out the chandelier.
"I'd be careful carrying it in those shoes," the security guard said.
"Point taken," Claire said. She should have had someone help her, but she couldn't find Locke or Jason. Claire scanned the crowd. She saw Jason standing at one of the tall cocktail tables, talking to Daphne Dixon. Daphne looked gorgeous in a coral halter dress that put her beautiful tits on display. Claire sighed. The sight of Jason and Daphne together unsettled her, but there was no time to pry them away from each other. And where was Locke? Okay, forget it. Claire would get the chandelier herself. There was a table outside the entrance of the tent where the chandelier was to sit and garner everyone's admiration on the way into dinner. Claire made her way across the field, her heels catching in the grass every now and again. There hadn't been rain, thank God, but a field was still a field. Flats would have been a better call, but the dress called for heels. She would pay for her vanity tomorrow when her feet ached. A couple stood outside the locked concession stand, deep in conversation. Claire did not look at them closely. She had no desire to interrupt, but then the woman made a noise, and Claire did look over. It was Isabel and Gavin.
"Isabel,"
Claire called out in spite of herself. "God, I tried to reach you all week." Isabel sniffed and adjusted the straps of her dress. Her dress was beautiful and simple, a red sheath with satin piping.
"Hello, Claire," she said.
Claire looked between Isabel and Gavin. "I don't mean to interrupt," she said. "I just came to get the chandelier."
"Oh, right," Isabel said.
"Is everything okay?" Claire wondered if Isabel was crying because of the article in Nan Mag. Was it that big of a deal? Or maybe she was upset that none of her friends had come to the event. Maybe she was crying over her bad divorce. Whatever it was, she had chosen a curious person to comfort her. Gavin. It gave Claire pause. I'm sorry, Claire said. I really didn't mean to interrupt. Just ignore me. Claire unlocked the concession stand. Behind her, the party raged. Despite the fact that there were no hors d'oeuvres to speak of, the gala was going smoothly. She had not had the nerve to pop into the green room to check on Matthew. If she found him drinking, she would unhinge. It was better not to know. Besides, if she popped in to see him and they got into a difficult conversation, he might start drinking. She would stay away and hope for the best. The concession stand had no lights, so Claire had to grope through the gathering dark for the chandelier. When she found the box, she became aware of Isabel and Gavin loitering by the open door. I've got it, Claire said. I'll unwrap it at the table. She hesitated before the doorway, indicating that they should make room, which they did, and Claire stepped through. Should she say anything else to Isabel? Isabel, even in the worst of times, had been upbeat and indomitable. She handwrote notes on hundreds of invitations, despite her shame. She got on the phone and interrogated caterers, including the head of the high school cafeteria. Claire should congratulate her, thank her, try one last time to connect with her. Tomorrow, Isabel French would be out of her life forever. But Claire stopped herself. Isabel most certainly did not want to be comforted by Claire. For all Claire knew, she could be the reason Isabel was crying. Claire had the chandelier, and right now she needed to concentrate on delivering it safely to the tent. All the way across the field in these heels? Claire proceeded slowly, carefully. The box was heavy. She set the chandelier down on the designated table and unpacked it, using scissors to free it from its cocoon of protective bubble wrap. A card beside the chandelier read, "Pull Taffy Chandelier in Fuchsia. Artist, Claire Danner Crispin. Starting bid, $25,000. People standing around the table oohed and awed when the chandelier was finally revealed. Claire tried not to smile, but even sitting on the table, the chandelier was magnificent. She had worked so, so hard. It's my first piece in nearly 2 years, she said to no one in particular. At that moment, she wished fervently that Locke would win it. She had made it for him. She touched the perfect arc of the first arm. 4.5 hours. 60 tries. Goodbye, she whispered. Goodbye. He'd had 3 six-packs since arriving for the sound check, so 18 beers. But it was nothing to worry about. Terry and Alfonso weren't happy with him, he could tell, but they weren't going to blow the whistle on him either. It was just beer. They were relieved he hadn't pulled the Tanqueray out. He could have whatever he wanted. There was a 19-year-old Nepali kid named G-Man in the green room whose job it was to fetch Max and the band whatever their hearts desired. What Matthew desired was beer, and beer he got. Heineken after Heineken, in cold green bottles. Namaste. He popped open another beer. Number 19. The worst thing about drinking beer was that he constantly had to urinate. On his last trip to the Port-a-John, he had felt lightheaded. Whether this was because of the beer or because of his deep melancholy at leaving the next day, he had no idea. He wanted to leave with Claire, but he had not been able yet to persuade her. He entertained fantasies of just staying on Nantucket, of living with Claire and Jason and their kids, like some kind of eccentric uncle. The fact of the matter was, he needed a family. He should have started one of his own, but his lifestyle hadn't cooperated. Too many drugs, too many late nights, too little chance for routine and consistency. Matthew sneaked peeks out of the tent across the field. Claire was in his crosshairs. He tried to appreciate the other women, but his eyes always landed on Claire. That green dress. It was impossible to believe that Claire was even prettier at 37 than she had been at 17, but yes, it was true. She had grown into herself. She had so much confidence now, such a way about her, a kindness mixed with competence. She floated, lit from within. At that second, Matthew saw Claire talking to a balding man in a pink tie. Claire tucked herself under his ear and whispered something. He, in turn, touched the small of her back, as though he was used to touching her. It was the head honcho of the charity. The guy had come into the green room and introduced himself a few minutes ago, but Matthew couldn't remember the man's name. Doc? Dick? The man had not seemed particularly starstruck to meet Max West, as so many people were, but he had been grateful and businesslike. Now Matthew saw this Dick guy and Claire were on intimate terms. God, the way he touched her just now, his hand on the small of her back, practically cupping her ass, made Matthew burn with jealousy. He couldn't trust himself, especially not when he'd been drinking. Was this Dick person the reason Claire had turned him down? Matthew called G-Man over.
Would you get me a Tanqueray? Splash of tonic, with a very fresh lime, he asked. Please.
It was going too fast. Already it was time to sit for dinner. Everybody was starving. The cocktail hour, always legendary, had been a bit lean in the food department. Claire took a deep breath and looked around the tent. This was it. The gala. The tent was lit by white Christmas lights and candles. The tables were decorated with crisp white linens, crystal goblets, and simple arrangements of pink tea roses in silver bowls. The tent shimmied with the sound of people talking and laughing. This was a beautiful party. Adams opened a bottle of champagne and poured some for Claire, and then kissed her cheek and said, "You did a great job." "It wasn't only me," Claire said. She peered at the next table. Locke was sitting between Heather and Isabel. Daphne was on the other side of Heather, and Gavin, who Claire now understood was Isabel's date, was sitting on the other side of Isabel. Dara, the cellist, was at the table with the date, and Astor Wyatt, the graphic designer, was there with his boyfriend. None of Isabel's other friends had shown up. Isabel looked positively morose. Claire raised her champagne flute in Isabel's direction. "We did it," she mouthed. Isabel looked away. Claire's heart faltered. She took a feeble sip, then set her glass down. Tomorrow, she reminded herself, it wouldn't matter what Isabel thought. Everything tends to go wrong at the last minute. They were past the point where everything could go wrong, weren't they? But Claire worried about dinner. Siobhan had not managed to get hors d'oeuvres out. Even Genevieve and her troop of 16-year-olds could have done better. When the waiter set down Claire's plate, however, her mind was put at ease. The food was beautiful. The beef tenderloin was rosy, the lobster salad creamy, the wild rice studded with dried cherries and golden raisins, like jewels. Claire checked around her. Service seemed even. Claire believed she could hear a collective sigh of relief, and then expressions of excitement and joy. Dinner. As dinner was being cleared, Locke stood up from his place. Claire's stomach clenched. She wasn't ready for this. Locke took a microphone from one of the production guys and said, in a booming voice that quieted everyone,
"Good evening."
Applause. People were feeling good now. They had been warmed by the cocktail hour, and they'd eaten. The evening was about to take off like a rocket ship.
"I'm Lockhart Dixon, executive director of Nantucket's Children, and I would like to thank you for coming to our summer gala."
More applause.
"Nantucket's Children was founded in 1992, when it came to the attention of our late founder, Margaret Kincaid, that the face of Nantucket was changing. There were children of working islanders whose basic needs were not being met. The island needed affordable housing options, better after-school programs, daycare. Locke went on. Claire knew the spiel. She looked around at the attractive, wealthy people surrounding her. Did they get it? Nantucket's children was about kids whose parents worked as hard as they could to make a life here. Nantucket's economy depended on this workforce. The island had a responsibility to care for these children. Locke finished his speech and raised his hands, and the lights in the tent dimmed. The video started on a screen that dropped down over the stage. Kids of all shapes, sizes, and colors playing ball, studying, riding bikes, walking in groups on the beach. The soundtrack played Lean on Me, and Claire missed it up. A picture of J.D. flashed on the screen, showing him sitting with a special needs preschool student, a book open between them. The Read to Me program, funded by Nantucket's children. Claire felt conflicted. To co-chair this gala had been so hard, so draining, and it had led her to such a complicated place. She looked at the kids' faces on the screen. The point of the gala was to raise money. Money would make a difference. She had taken the job as co-chair because she wanted to help, because she wanted to return some goodwill to the universe. But it had backfired. Or had it? Claire's nerves attacked her thighs, her knees. She knew what was coming. She looked over at Isabel's table and was alarmed to see Isabel stand up, push her chair in, and stroll to the back of the tent. Where was she going? Didn't she know the thank yous were next on the program? Gavin stood and followed Isabel out. Adams ambled up onto the stage and took the microphone from Locke. Claire turned around, searching in vain for Isabel. She was gone. Claire tried to signal to Adams, but he was off and running on his president of the board speech. He thanked Gavin. Polite applause, though now Gavin was missing too. And then he thanked Locke, and Locke returned to the stage to take a bow. Claire looked at Daphne. She was, as ever, scowling, and then Daphne stood up and walked out. The applause was deafening, or so it seemed to Claire. She was gripped with fear. Here was the moment she had been waiting for, or one of the moments, and she was dreading it. No, she thought. Her face blossomed into two red posies. Calm down. She had done harder things than this. She had kept her cool while they performed an emergency C-section and pulled Zach out. Living? Dead? Healthy? Impaired? She had been introduced during the unveiling of Bubbles 3 at the Whitney Museum. She had been photographed by the New York Times. She had banged the tambourine against her hip in front of a packed house at the Stone Pony. She must have had chutzpah then. Well, if she'd had it, she'd lost it. She worked alone in the hot shop. She raised her family. She was not the kind of person who could accept a bouquet of flowers in front of an intimidating crowd like this. Her heels would snap. She would fall. There would be a stain on her dress in an embarrassing place. There would be something stuck in her teeth. She checked again for Isabel. Gone. In the bathroom. And Daphne. Gone. And Matthew, too. Would miss her shining moment. Was it even worth having a shining moment if the right people weren't there to watch? Isabel. It is now my distinct pleasure, Adam said, to introduce the two women who have made this evening possible. These women have been working for nearly a year. They have raised money, called in favors, turned over their lives in service to Nantucket's children and the summer gala. Please, put your hands together for our gala co-chairs, ladies and gentlemen, Claire Danner Crispin and Isabel French. Later, Claire would say she'd heard the crash. The sound was trapped in her subconscious. The sound of glass breaking. And so, even as Claire walked up on stage to accept an armload of lilies and delphiniums, prom queen, Academy Award, Miss America,
Her spirit was in a free fall, about to land with a sickening thud. The plan for the auction was as follows. Pietro da Silva would walk in from the back of the tent, holding the chandelier aloft, and for additional drama, Ted Trimble had rigged a battery pack so that the chandelier would be illuminated. Pietro da Silva was a professional auctioneer. He moonlighted for every charity on the island, and he liked to make things interesting. Strolling through a darkened tent with the precious chandelier aglow had been his idea. Auction as theater. Why not? The price would go up. Claire was in a state of heightened agitation. The flowers of the bouquet brushed against her face. She was aware that Isabel had not come up on stage with her. Claire had posed for the photographers of both island newspapers with Adams alone. Did the audience find it strange that Isabel was missing? Claire wasn't sure, nor was she quite sure what was wrong inside her heart, but something was definitely wrong. On stage, with the lights in her eyes, she tried to locate Jason. Where was Jason? She thought of Jason as she had first known him, his young face glowing warm and orange from the bonfire up at Great Point. He had brought a cooler of cherry stone clams, and he shucked them there on the beach and fed them to Claire, each one a tiny, sweet, perfect present. That Jason was gone, and in his place she now had... What? The man who had grabbed her hand when Zach took his first steps, who kissed her throat, the man who had returned to sleep beside her, even though she had strayed so far away from herself. Jason, where was her husband? She felt that something awful had happened. One of their children had burned to cinders in the hot shop. Where was Jason? His spot at their table was empty. Shay was throwing up in bed all alone. Ottilie had been stolen from the house by a stranger who had been stalking her for months. In the back of the tent, all the way in the back, Claire saw Siobhan, her face as pale and pinched as a pie crust, genuflecting in her white chef's jacket. Someone was dead. When Claire stepped off the stage, Locke was waiting for her with a stricken face. Everything tends to go wrong at the last minute. Here it was, the last minute.
The chandelier fell, Locke said. It broke.
It fell, Claire thought. It broke. Broke? She said.
Smashed,
Locke said. Not possible, Claire thought. The security guard had been hired specifically to make sure that nothing happened to it. The crowd quieted as Locke led Claire out of the tent by the arm. They did not know what had happened, but they sensed tragedy. Adams spoke into the microphone with rousing enthusiasm. Enjoy your dessert. Max West will begin his concert in a matter of minutes. It was not a tragedy. The chandelier, after all, was only a thing. And yet, when Claire saw it, lying lopsided in the grass, broken, smashed, ruined, she cried out. And then she just plain cried, blubbered, sobbed. She turned to Locke and said, Where is Jason? Hands came around her. I'm right here, baby. God, I am so sorry. Claire collapsed into him. She was crying so hard that Jason couldn't understand what she was saying. She had to concentrate on taking a breath, repeating herself.
I want you to call the babysitter. Ask her, are the kids okay?
I'm sure they're fine.
Call her.
There was something terribly wrong. Claire felt it. The lighter. J.D. had set the house on fire with the goddamned lighter. He had been flicking it on and off under his covers. Claire should have taken the evil thing with her when she left the house. The covers of his bed caught fire in the rest of his room. The rest of the upstairs where the children were sleeping, they would die of smoke inhalation. Hannah, the babysitter, had decided to crash the concert after all. She had left the children alone, and now they were dead. Jason called. Claire was limp against him, shivering. Everyone gathered in a loose circle. Locke, Adams, Ted and Amy Trimble. Brent and Julie Jackson. Not Siobhan, though Claire had seen her a few moments earlier. Not Isabel. Not Gavin. Not Daphne. Jason hung up his phone. The kids are fine, he said. They're all asleep.
Even Zach?
Even Zach.
And Hannah's there? You talk to Hannah?
Hannah's there. Pan's there. The kids are safe.
Okay.
She was allowed now to let go. Her anger, her rage, her disappointment, her heartbreak. The house was not on fire. Her children were safe in bed. The chandelier was only a thing, an inanimate object. A thing, Claire. She chastised herself for her hot fountain of tears, but they were not to be stopped. Hundreds of hours of work, all that stress and strain, a trip to the hospital. She'd nearly died because of that goddamned chandelier. She'd returned to the hot shop only to create it. It was a labor of love, the best kind of charity, and now it was gone. She turned on the gathered crowd in fury.
How did it happen? She demanded. Who knocked it over? It didn't just fall over all by itself. And where is the security guard? He was supposed to be watching it.
No one answered. Isabel, Claire thought. She left the tent, and then, seconds later, the chandelier fell. She had been so disillusioned with Claire from the beginning.
Where is Isabel? Claire asked.
She's back in the tent, Adam said, eating dessert. I can't find Gavin, Locke said. I thought he was having a cigarette, but I've looked everywhere. He's vanished.
Vanished? Claire thought.
Gavin wasn't her favorite person, but there was no reason for him to break her chandelier, topple it and run, like some kid who had put a baseball through a window. Someone probably knocked it over by accident, Jason said.
By accident? Claire thought.
By what? Carelessly swinging a purse? It would have to have been a pretty big purse. By carrying a tray loaded down with dessert samplers? Siobhan had been in the back of the tent, crossing herself. In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit, do you not care about your soul, Claire? Claire had seen her, but now where was she? Where was she now when Claire needed her? Siobhan was angry, Claire knew it. She was resentful. She had not wanted to cater the gala. She had wanted to be eating and drinking and wearing her sexy black dress, not waiting on everyone hand and foot like a servant. She had sat in judgment on Claire. She had quite possibly decided on her own to make Claire hang.
I can't believe nobody saw what happened, Claire said. Where was the security guard?
There were crashers, Adam said. A bunch of girls trying to get in without tickets. He was dealing with them. Claire strode up to the bar and cornered the bartender. Hunter, his name was. He had worked for Carter and Siobhan for years.
Did you see who did it? Claire asked him. You must have seen something.
He held up his palms. My back was turned, he said. I saw nothing. There were only a few people who had seen what happened, and one of them was Max West, who had been standing outside the door of the green room, drinking a cold, stinging Tanqueray and tonic. Max had had his eyes glued on the opening of the big tent. He was trying to hear what was being said inside. The blue Solo cup was filled to the top with forbidden gin. Everything for Max was swaying and shimmering. He had finally arrived at that place he liked to visit when he was drinking. That place where he wasn't sure what was real and what wasn't. That place where the world and the people and events and circumstances in it seemed to have been created for his bemusement. Constantly, while drunk, he tilted his head in wonder. He had seen the chandelier fall, had seen who knocked it over, but he was afraid to open his mouth, to blow the whistle, because it just as easily could have been his fault. He had been lurching after only a few steps. He, too, was capable of causing a catastrophic accident. The chandelier fell. It smashed in the grass, although the word smash indicated sound, and all Matthew heard was a muted crunch. Matthew looked at the chandelier in the grass. Should he pick it up? He thought, I have to stop drinking. Back in the green room, he threw back two shots of espresso and tried to get Bruce on the phone. Bruce was at the gym in Burbank, on the treadmill. He was hesitant to get off. He had to lose 20 pounds, his doctor said, or he was going to have a heart attack. Is this an emergency, Max? Bruce said. Matthew said,
yes.
Matthew tried to explain it as concisely as he could. The auction item, a chandelier that Claire had made, had broken, and the charity would need something to auction in its place. What can we give?
It has to be something really good, Matthew said. They expected this chandelier to go for like 50 grand.
$50,000, Bruce said. Jesus, Max, haven't you done enough for this woman? You're playing a free concert. And you bought her table, right, for 25 grand? That's enough, Max, that's plenty. Why do you feel you have to give her anything else?
I don't have to, Matthew said. I want to.
How to explain it? He would do anything for Claire. He was on a mission here.
What can we give them?
Bruce sighed. How about two tickets to your London concert on Christmas Eve, with two backstage passes?
That's a start, but it has to be bigger than that. Think big, Bruce.
How about we add first-class airfare, seven nights in a suite at the Connaught, and Christmas Eve dinner at Gordon Ramsay's place with you, Elton John, and Paul McCartney?
I'm having Christmas Eve dinner with Elton John and Paul McCartney.
You are.
Genius, Matthew said. Thank you, Bruce. That should do it.
Gavin hurried down the grassy strip on the edge of Old South Road, with only the tip of his cigarette for illumination. He was running, but because he was pitifully out of shape, he would lose his breath, hack out a cough, and be forced to stop and walk. He had called the airline from his cell phone and booked himself under an assumed name on the last flight off the island. He was leaving Nantucket. He had dumped all the money, minus $500 to get him wherever he was going, into the back seat of Ben Franklin's Lincoln Continental. He told himself it wasn't stealing, since he had given the money back. It was just some awful game he'd had fun with for a while. It killed him to leave Isabel, but she deserved better than him. She deserved someone powerful and clever, not some two-bit criminal. Leaving now, he was doing Isabel a favor, and Locke and Claire, too. He could ruin their lives, rip apart both their families, but what would that accomplish? Nothing but heartbreak. He sneaked out while Isabel was in the bathroom. He stood on the far side of the parking lot for a few minutes. He couldn't tear himself away until he learned what would happen to the auction. What happened was this. Pietro da Silva and Max West got up on stage and offered the most outrageous auction package the island had ever seen. Concert tickets, backstage passes, airfare, hotel, Christmas Eve dinner with Max, Sir Elton John, and Sir Paul McCartney, or as Max West self-deprecatingly joked,
two knights and a knave.
It went for $100,000, and Max West offered it again for another $100,000. $200,000. Gavin found his heart soaring. So much money for the charity. So much more than they'd expected. It was weird, the elation that Gavin experienced at the gala's success. It was backward. He ran. He was almost to the turnoff for the airport when the lights came up behind him. He threw down his cigarette, squashed it in the grass, then felt ashamed of himself for littering. The lights were not the lights he'd been fearing. Or were they? He debated between turning around to check and simply bolting. How much speed did he have left? Enough to make it to the airport? The airport wouldn't be safe now anyway. He would have to hide, but where? The lights were spinning and flashing. Yes, definitely police lights, but possibly not for him. He turned. A cruiser pulled up right alongside him. There were two cops in the front seat and an old man in the back. Ben Franklin.
Gavin Andrews, the driver said.
It was over then. Gavin sunk his hands deep into the pockets of his Madras pants and looked back toward the tent. He was half a mile away, but he could still hear the strains of Max West's singing. The tune, whatever it was catchy.
Put your hands where we can see them, the second officer barked.
Gavin raised his hands over his head, the way he'd seen it done in the movies. Everyone Gavin knew was committing crimes, large and small, engaging in scandals, acts of corruption, delinquency, and plain old bad faith. But he was the one who had gotten caught. It figured. He had never sounded better. Although Claire was shrouded with sadness and rage, she could still tell how good he sounded. Matthew, Max West, was putting on a terrific show. He was playing all his hits, and the guests were all dancing and singing along at the top of their lungs. Claire was dancing with Jason, Ted and Amy Trimble, and Adams and Heidi Fisk. They were surrounding her in a circle, buffering her, as though she were the one who might break. The chandelier was gone. Every time Claire thought this, it sickened her. It was Hemingway's novel, left on a train. It was Degas' ballerinas gone up in smoke. The worst thought was that other people might not view her loss that way. They might see it as nothing more than broken glass, easily swept up, easily replaced by concert tickets and dinner with celebrities, which had, in fact, brought in 4 times as much money as the chandelier might have. Max West, everyone said, had swung in on a vine. He had saved the day. But that didn't begin to mend the gash in Claire's spirit. She had dedicated the better part of a year to the chandelier. It was the finest work she'd ever done, and it would fall into oblivion. There was no consolation for that. She felt a tap on her shoulder. Locke. Everyone was dancing, but Locke was just standing there, staring at her with an expression that threatened to give it all away.
I need to talk to you, he said.
Now?
Yes, he said.
She didn't want to miss even 1 second of the concert, but then Max segued into a cover of Dancing Queen, and since it wasn't actually his song, Claire felt okay stepping out. As they strolled through the tent, Locke tried to take her hand. Claire glared at him.
What are you doing? She said. Are you drunk? Where's your wife, your daughter?
Daphne left because she thought I was paying too much attention to Isabel, he said. And Heather went downtown to meet her friends.
Where are we going?
I want to show you something, he said. In the concession stand.
I don't think that's a good idea, Claire said.
Please, 5 minutes.
She followed him across the shadowy field to the dark concession stand. He pointed to the box.
I packed it up for you, he said. The remains, what was left.
This is what you wanted to show me?
I knew it would be important to you, he said. Important that it not get thrown away.
She peered into the box. It was too dark to see clearly, but she could make out the lopsided form of the broken chandelier and a pile of shards. The box was a casket now.
You didn't have to keep the shards, she said. They're dangerous.
I didn't have the heart to throw them away.
This was a gesture on his part, an effort he'd made to say he understood her loss. But he didn't. He put his arms around her.
I love you, Claire. All this year, what we've been through, it was for that reason. I love you.
She rested her hands on his jacket lapels. She thought back over the past year, the times she met him secretly, the moments right before they parted when she was sure she would die from longing, the confusing time she spent with Father Dominic, asking herself over and over again, How can a good person do something so bad? She would have liked to believe that what she was acting on now was the strength she'd prayed for. But the truth was, her feelings for Locke were weakened and confused. She thought about the afternoon he came to the house to talk about the catering. He had been so foreign to her on that day, so distinct from the man she loved, the man she wanted to climb the Eiffel Tower with, reincarnate Frank Sinatra for, even stand next to in line at the post office. On that pleasant, sunny afternoon, Claire couldn't wait for Locke to leave. She thought about the morning when Locke helped her transport the chandelier. They had sat side by side in the car, Locke driving, Claire riding, as they might have if they were a real couple. But those minutes had been silent and awkward, because what was meaningful between them was lost, at least to Claire. And then last night, when Matthew made his plea,
"I want you to come with me. Marry me."
Claire had thought, "I could never leave Jason. I could never leave the kids." But Locke, she could leave with ease. It was Locke she had wanted to run away from. "We are so lucky that the only thing that broke was the chandelier," she said. She raised her head and looked at him. For much of the past year, he had seemed wonderful and mysterious. He had seemed all-knowing, a repository of wisdom and right answers and sound judgment. He had served as her savior. She had been needy in ways she didn't even know about, and he had filled her up. But he was wrong about there being no hell. There was a hell, and they had narrowly avoided it. "We could have ruined our lives. My marriage could have broken up, or yours could have. Our kids, your job, our friends, our lives. They all could have ended up in the trash." Claire thought of herself living with Locke in a rental house, with Claire's children in strange rooms, displaced and resentful. After 6 months, Locke would be going to work at night to escape her. She, in turn, would be making secret phone calls to Jason. Claire shook the image from her head and filled up with an emotion that was as thick as syrup, an emotion she could only describe as bittersweet. God, she had loved Locke Dixon so completely, with such bright intensity that it had blinded her. But now, finally, it had burned itself out.
"Claire."
She smoothed his tie. The worst thing about adultery, in the end, was that it had shaken her belief in the things she had always held sacred. Love, marriage, friendship. "I need something from you," she said.
"Yes, of course," Locke said. "God, anything."
He was earnest, supplicant, hurting. He had been hurting since she'd met him. He was the injured bird on the side of the road, the one no one would stop to save but her. He was the tar in her hair, on her hands, weighing one side of her head down, impossible to get out. He was the one person she had been unable to say no to. Until now. "I need you to let me go." Locke nodded. He was stunned, maybe. Or maybe, in his infinite wisdom, he was saying,
"Yes, you're right. Go now while you can."
Claire didn't ask. She hurried back toward the bright tent, toward the music. Siobhan knew what her childhood priest, Father Kennedy, would say. They were all, every last one of them, sinners. That included Carter, her gambling husband, and Claire, her adulterous best friend. That included Siobhan herself. The whole thing had happened so fast, the way it had when Liam broke his arm. One second he was handling the puck, and the next second he was up against the boards, then down on the ice, his arm dangling off him. Siobhan had been setting out dessert samplers and listening to Locke Dixon up on stage, giving his sappy Save the Children speech. To Siobhan, the whole idea that this evening, with its cocktails and canapes and women in their summer diamonds, had anything to do with the actual children and working families of Nantucket was fucking nonsense. This evening was about the guests celebrating their own wealth and good fortune. It was about seeing a famous rock star up close. It wasn't about doing the right thing so much as being seen doing the right thing. Some people under the tent probably had no idea which charity their money was even benefiting. The whole world of charity benefits, Siobhan decided, was shallow and obnoxious. But perhaps that was too cynical. Siobhan was just tired, bone-weary, and suffering from a foul, foul mood caused by visions of Carter at the roulette wheel. She had just stepped out of the tent when the security guard, a doughy guy from the UK, rushed past her. There were people, crashers, Max West fanatics trying to jump the fence. For most of the evening, there had been people lingering outside the tent, getting fresh drinks, sneaking a cigarette, going to the bathroom. But now everyone was packed inside, listening to the speeches, waiting for Max West to hit the stage. The only people behind the tent were her bartender, Hunter, and at the bar, Mr. Ben Franklin, who appeared to be talking to himself. Siobhan felt a stab of empathy. She had been talking to herself all night long, and nothing she'd said had been very nice. Siobhan looked to her right and saw Isabel French pick up Claire's chandelier. It was dangling from Isabel's left hand. Isabel was saying something to Gavin that Siobhan couldn't hear. Siobhan thought back to the night of the soiree intime and how awful Isabel had been, harassing Claire about taking a $25,000 table. It had been no better than sorority hazing. Siobhan did not like the sight of Isabel holding Claire's chandelier so carelessly. Siobhan did not think before she spoke. She barked at Isabel in the meanest shanty Irish voice she could muster. "Put that down!" Her voice was too loud and too sudden. It was a gunshot in the dark. It caused Ben Franklin to spill his drink all over the bar, and Isabel, naturally skittish, drunk, holding carelessly onto the cord, swung around and the chandelier swung with her. Siobhan cried out. Gavin cried out. The chandelier narrowly missed hitting the edge of the table. Isabel turned on Siobhan accusingly.
"What? Put it down," Siobhan said.
Gavin took the chandelier from Isabel and set it safely back on the table. Isabel looked like she was about to burst into tears.
"I'm going to the bathroom,"
Gavin said. "I'll wait for you right here." Siobhan glared at him, thinking of his coming out to spy on her and Edward that night. He was creepy. He would not look at Siobhan now, would not offer an apologetic word on behalf of his date. In so many ways, the two of them deserved each other. Gavin lit up a cigarette, flipped open his cell phone, and disappeared into the shadows. Siobhan touched the chandelier gingerly. It was as delicate as spun sugar. To think that Isabel had nearly cracked it. Inside the tent, the slideshow was playing. Adams would be next with the thank yous, and Claire would be last, the biggie. Siobhan knew she should not begrudge Claire her moment of recognition, but begrudge it she did. It wasn't fair that Claire got everything. She was the artist. She was the gala co-chair. She was the nice to Siobhan's naughty. She had received the first child pearls from their father-in-law, Malcolm. Every time Claire wore them, like tonight, it was a slap in the face to Siobhan. Siobhan loved Claire better than any other woman in the world, but along with that love came resentment. "You want naughty?" Siobhan indulged in a mean little fantasy where she trashed the chandelier. She had not dropped or spilled anything in more than 2 years, since the full sherry glasses went over in Martin Scorsese's lap during the film festival. Siobhan was due for an unfortunate accident. Siobhan pictured herself the villainess in this story, then shivered. Awful. She was so absorbed in the thoughts of a horrible sinner that she did not notice Daphne Dixon coming out of the tent until Daphne was practically on top of her. What she saw only registered in the corner of her eye as a flare, a flame-colored blur, and that was what Siobhan meant by fast. 1 minute, Siobhan was standing alone by the chandelier, contemplating the injustices of her life, and the next minute there was Daphne, drunk, stumbling out of the tent, headed for Siobhan. She looked like she wanted to tell Siobhan something. Oh dear Lord, what was she going to say? Or maybe she just needed someone to hold her up. Daphne was a lot bigger than Siobhan, and she had a frightening amount of momentum. She knocked into Siobhan. Siobhan knocked into the table. The table tilted. The chandelier slid to the ground. Crash. In the grass. And then whipped by its own chain. Oh, no. Broken. So broken. Siobhan untangled herself from Daphne. Daphne got to her feet unsteadily. She took her shoes off. Were her shoes the problem? And staggered away.
Daphne! Daphne, come back here!
Daphne did not turn around, though she stumbled again. She was very drunk. Siobhan's first thought was that she could not let Daphne get into a car. Siobhan chased Daphne out to the parking lot. She caught up to her and grabbed her arm.
You're not driving, Siobhan said.
It was an accident, Daphne said. Accident, accident, accident. Don't worry. It wasn't your fault.
Siobhan tightened her grip on Daphne's arm and flagged the security guard, who was threading his way through the parking lot. Should she tell him about the chandelier, smashed to bits in the grass? Who had knocked it over?
Don't worry, it wasn't your fault.
Damn right it wasn't. But Siobhan had been standing in the wrong place. She should have been in the airless catering tent doing dishes. Siobhan had the sick feeling it was her fault. Siobhan had knocked it over, right? She wasn't sure. It had happened so fast.
Accident, accident, accident.
Yes, it was an accident. Claire and Siobhan should have absolutely insisted that Daphne get into a cab so many years ago. Claire had always felt guilty about that, but Siobhan hadn't, though now Siobhan could see that Claire was right.
Don't worry, it wasn't your fault.
But it was their fault. Their inaction had been negligent, criminal. They had let Daphne drive home, despite the fact that she was wearing the lampshade. They might as well have handed her a loaded gun. If they had only stopped Daphne, everything now would be different. Or would it?
This woman needs a cab, Siobhan said to the security guard. She shouldn't be driving.
I'm fine, Daphne spat.
Please, put her in a cab, Siobhan said. She's been drinking.
The security guard wheeled Daphne toward the exit.
Will do. Ma'am, where do you live?
Siobhan headed back to the tent, gravel crunching under her kitchen clogs. They were, all of them, sinners. When Siobhan returned, the tent was rumbling with applause. She approached Hunter at the bar, who was mopping up Ben Franklin's drink.
If anyone asks, Siobhan said to Hunter, tell them your back was turned.
Hunter nodded. Siobhan entered the back of the tent as Claire rose to accept her flowers. Siobhan would tell her what had happened later, privately. After all the hours Claire had devoted to the chandelier, it had taken only 10 seconds to destroy. Less, 5 seconds, 3 seconds. How would Claire forgive her? She would, Siobhan knew, because she was Claire. Siobhan thought of the blue velvet bag in the secret compartment of her jewelry box, empty now. She had sold the ring for $7,500 and donated it, anonymously, to Nantucket's children, even though she very much needed the money.
Carter.
What was Carter doing right this second? Was he thinking of her? Sensing her angst and torment? Or was he stoned from throwing the dice? She had to get him help. But where? From whom? She would have to suck up the little pride she had left and ask Locke Dixon. He would have the answer. Forgiveness. Siobhan closed her eyes and crossed herself.
In the name of the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
It was all she could think of to do. It was 5 minutes to 10, and he was growing hoarse. That really was the worst effect of drinking before a show. He didn't forget words or lose the melody, but his voice deteriorated. He still had 2 songs to sing, He nuzzled the microphone.
This last song is for my friend, Claire Danner.
The word friend was lame and insufficient, but he couldn't very well tell 1,000 of Claire's friends and peers that he had fallen back in love with her. Still, he added,
when I wrote this song 20 years ago, I wrote it for her.
He looked down into the audience. Claire's eyes were glassy. She blinked. Tears fell. Matthew strummed the first chord, and the band eased into Stormy Eyes. He wanted her to come up on stage. He wanted her to sing the last verse with him. Nobody realized this, but Claire could sing. High school chorus, soprano section. He tried to wave her up. She shook her head. She was dancing with underwhelming Jason. Dick wasn't around. Matthew felt hopeful. At the end of Stormy Eyes, the concert was officially over. The lights went out. The crowd screamed. They wanted more. Matthew smiled. At $1,000 a ticket, he had expected a different crowd, more genteel, more reserved. But this group rivaled 60,000 New Yorkers at Shea Stadium in the noise department.
All right,
Matthew said into the microphone. He had an encore, one final song, and he had given it a lot of thought. He had, in fact, arranged for this song even before he arrived on the island. He had called each of the contract musicians himself, one second tenor, one baritone, one bass, and made sure they all knew Barbershop. Nobody would understand but her, and that was okay, because she was the only one who mattered. He waited until the crowd grew quiet, absolutely silent, and then he hit the first perfect note. Sweet Rosie O'Grady, my dear little Rose. It was how he'd gotten her before. It was all he had left. And yes, she was smiling ear to ear. And yes, tears were streaming down her face. And yes, it was as though they were the only two people in the place, Matthew Westfield and Claire Danner, high school sweethearts from Wildwood Crest, New Jersey. But as the quartet closed in on the end of the song, as their four voices blended with a beauty and a poignancy that Matthew himself could scarcely believe, "And Rosie O'Grady Loves Me," Claire looked him right in the eye and shook her head.
"No," she said, "I can't."
Matthew clipped the note. The lights went out. The audience keened. He was intensely jealous then, as jealous as he'd ever been, not of underwhelming Jason, and not of Dick, but of having a life that you couldn't, or didn't want to, leave behind.
"No," he thought, "you shouldn't."
It was time for him to go. Claire woke up to Jason kissing the back of her neck.
"What time is it?" she said.
6.
"Too early."
She closed her eyes. He let her sleep until 9, an unbelievable luxury. When she came out into the kitchen, the kids had all been fed and the breakfast dishes were washed. Pan was sitting on the sofa reading to Zach. She was still spotted, but she felt better. Jason was standing at the counter making sandwiches. Claire watched him in amazement. He lined up the bread and slathered one with mayo, oddly, one with mustard, JD, and one with mustard and butter, Shay. When he saw Claire, he stopped what he was doing and poured her a cup of coffee. Claire kissed him and said,
"Thank you for letting me sleep."
"Picnic for the beach today," he said.
"Okay," Claire said.
"Where's Matthew?" "He left."
"He left?"
"His plane took off at 7, for Spain. I drove him to the airport."
"He told me his flight was at 10, Claire said. "He didn't even say goodbye."
Jason cleared his throat and started laying down slices of ham. He told me to tell you he loves you, but that he understands. Claire nodded. Jason closed the sandwiches, then sliced them with the big knife. You pulled off a great event, despite everything. You should be proud of yourself, Claire. Claire took her coffee out to the back deck, stood at the railing, and looked out over the golf course. It was a glorious day. Her head should have hurt, but it didn't. Her heart should have hurt, but it didn't either. The chandelier was broken. On the way home from the gala, Claire had asked Jason to stop by the grocery store. Claire was about to toss the box into the dumpster, but she found she couldn't part with it so unceremoniously. The chandelier, broken or whole, represented a year of her life. And weren't there things about the past year that had been valuable? Wasn't there anything she could salvage? She could, she decided, salvage the chandelier. She thought of Mr. Fred Bulrush in San Francisco, for whom she had made the pulled taffy candlesticks. She would repair the chandelier, and he would buy it, if it was lopsided, if it had hairline cracks, if it had dings and scars, if it contained a story of love and betrayal and ecstasy and regret. So much the better.
It's like all of a sudden you don't care about your soul.
Stand in line together at the post office.
You must pray for strength.
We need someone who can give it a dedicated effort. There's been an accident.
Oh my God, I am heartily sorry for having offended you, and I detest all my sins. They don't know about the baby.
I've been watching for you for, about 5 days. Live with me. Marry me.
When all this is over, do I get you back?
He's a walker.
Ladies and gentlemen, Claire Danner Crispin. It would mark her triumphant return.
This has been a Hachette Audio production of A Summer Affair, written by Ellen Hildebrand, read by Isabel Keating, produced and directed by John Clem, engineered by Tommy Herron, post-production by Gabino Reyes. A Summer Affair is also available in print from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group USA. Text copyright 2008 by Ellen Hildebrand. Audio production copyright and published 2008 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. Except as permitted under the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, no part of this production may be reproduced, distributed, or transmitted in any form or by any means, or stored in a database or retrieval system without the prior written permission of the publisher.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.